From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
A small no-approach zone outside a reproductive health facility prevents harm to women before it happens and provides clear rules that actually promote free speech.
The proposed clinic access provision sweeps too broadly and would prohibit traditional First Amendment activities such as labor leafleting.
A discussion on buffer zones and free speech, not only at women's health clinics, but also in the form of a 9-foot wall around the IMF and World Bank meetings. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A senior Bush administration official said yesterday the United States had given Russia an unofficial deadline of November to agree to changes in the anti-ballistic missile treaty or face a unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the Arms Control Accord. It's the first time a member of the Bush administration has set a time limit for consultations that Bush pledged to undertake before developing a new national missile defense system. Such a system contravenes the 1972 treaty, which Russia has called the cornerstone of global strategic stability. American withdrawal from the treaty 6 months after a formal notification to Moscow would pave the way for the start of construction of a missile defense test site in Alaska. A Pentagon spokesperson announced yesterday that ground clearing for missile silos and a command center at Fort Greely, 100 miles southeast of Fairbanks, is to begin this week. The U.S. government came under fire yesterday over its stance during Rwanda's 1994 mass killings following the release of declassified official documents showing Washington anticipated events now seen as among the most gruesome atrocities of the late 20th century. Sally Booker, director of the Africa Policy Center, says the documents show the U.S. was aware of the scale of the killings, but adopted a course of inaction in addition to preventing others from intervening in a way that could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. The documents were released yesterday by the National Security Archive. The genocide was triggered by the apparent assassination of the Rwandan Hutu president. Shortly afterwards, a Pentagon official noted in a memo to the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense that, quote, unless both sides can be convinced to return to the peace process, a massive bloodbath will ensue that would likely spill over into Burundi. But just 3 days later, the State Department instructed the U.S. mission at the United Nations to work toward a withdrawal of the Rwanda-based UN force that many believe could have helped protect civilians. By the end of June, an estimated 800,000 people were killed by government-backed militias. The documents also show U.S. officials warned against calling the massacres genocide because Washington would then have to act. The U.S. is a signatory to anti-genocide conventions of 1948. A U.S. State Department spokesperson said yesterday the priority at the time had been protecting U.S. citizens. Prosecutors detained 16 members of a delegation of South Korean civic leaders who were suspected of violating South Korea's anti-communist law during a trip to North Korea. The group of 311 South Korean delegates returned home yesterday following a controversial trip to North Korea for a joint celebration of Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial rule in 1945. The South Korean delegation consisted of religious leaders, academics, dissidents, and civic representatives. On their return to South Korea, they were met at the airport by some 3,000 helmeted police. Earlier, scuffles erupted as police tried to take away white and blue flags that showed an undivided Korean peninsula from a group of activists who showed up to welcome the visitors. NATO's Supreme Commander gave the go-ahead for deploying troops to Macedonia yesterday, setting the stage for another NATO commitment in the volatile Balkans region. The NATO force will include a small U.S. component limited to logistics and intelligence. Unlike the open-ended peacekeeping mission in Kosovo, the NATO force in Macedonia will have a carefully circumscribed assignment, says the U.S. government. The troops have been ordered only to gather weapons from ethnic Albanian rebels who have risen up against the Slavic-dominated government in Skopje. The rebels agreed to disarm as part of a ceasefire signed August 12th by leading Macedonian ethnic Albanian political parties. The conservative-led Iranian judiciary sentenced a reformist member of parliament to 22 months in prison, finding her guilty of numerous charges, including, quote, propagating against the Islamic regime. The announcement comes as the reform-dominated Iranian parliament continued with a long debate on cabinet nominees proposed by President Mohammad Khatami. Kathy Boudin, the activist who participated in a 1981 Brinks truck robbery in which a guard and two police officers were killed, will go before a parole board today, but the relatives of the victims are campaigning to prevent her release from prison. Since Boudin pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was given a sentence of 20 years to life, she's become a model prisoner, according to officials at the facility. The Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in Westchester County is where she is incarcerated. She developed an AIDS education program that's been adopted by prisons nationwide. She's earned a master's degree in education and won a 1999 Penn Award for her poetry. If she is released on parole, her lawyer says, she will begin studying for a doctorate in higher education at Columbia University's Teacher College and will work with AIDS patients at a local hospital. But a group opposed to Boudin's release, Concerns of Brinks Survivors, has held a candlelight vigil and mounted a letter-writing campaign. As of yesterday afternoon, the campaign had produced 35,000 pieces of mail objecting to the possibility of parole. At today's hearing, parole commissioners will consider letters for and against her release, as well as a 450-page volume her attorney, Leonard Weinglass, has put together to describe her positive activities in prison. Among her letters of support is one from a prison chaplain who calls Boudin one of the 10 holiest people she has encountered. If the parole board approves Boudin's application, she may get out of prison as early as October. If it's denied, she could wait up to 2 years for a new hearing.
I opened a bank account when I was 9 years old. I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I had saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice. I passed their handheld signs, I went through their picket lines. They gathered when they saw me coming, they shouted when they saw me cross. I said, why don't you go home, just leave me alone. I'm just another woman lost. You are like fish in the water who don't know that they are wet. As far as I can tell, the world isn't perfect yet.
Lost Woman Song, Ani DiFranco here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Several weeks ago in Wichita, Kansas, the anti-abortion Summer of Mercy renewal campaign targeted one of the few clinics in the nation that perform late-term abortions. After marching on a Saturday morning, hundreds of abortion opponents knelt and prayed on the sidewalks across the street from the clinic operated by George Tiller, while abortion rights supporters gathered behind fences at the clinic entrance and across the street. Dr. Tiller's clinic was bombed in 1985, and Tiller was shot and wounded outside the clinic in 93, 2 years after the first Summer of Mercy march was staged in Wichita. But Operation Save America won a court fight with the city when a federal judge ruled that the city's denial of a parade permit violated the organization's First Amendment rights. Today, we're going to have a debate on one way that clinics have come up with to deal with protests and harassment outside. Yesterday, the New York City Council Public Safety Committee held hearings on legislation which would create a 10-foot buffer zone around people within 50 feet of a reproductive health clinic. Protesters would not be able to, quote, knowingly approach patients within 10 feet to pass them leaflets or engage in oral protest, education, or counseling with them without their consent. The New York legislation is modeled on a Colorado Supreme Court ruling from last year, which upheld a 100-foot buffer zone within health facilities and would prohibit unwanted approaches within 8 feet in that zone. The Supreme Court held that the Colorado law does not violate protesters' First Amendment rights. We're going to have a debate on this, and then we'll be joined by a lawyer in Washington, D.C., who has sued the government because of a 9-foot fence that is expected to be put up by the Washington, D.C. police to allow the World Bank and IMF meetings to go forward when the anti-globalization protesters come to town to Washington, D.C. at the end of September. But first, to this issue of buffer clinics around women's health clinics. We're joined by Jennifer Brown, who's director of the Reproductive Rights Unit in the Civil Rights Bureau of the Office of the New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Arthur Eisenberg is with us, legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and Deborah Sweet from the Reproductive Freedom Task Force of Refuse and Resist. Jennifer Brown, can you lay out what you said before the New York City Council yesterday about why you support these buffer zones and what the legislation actually is?
What this legislation would do is establish a small area 50 feet around the entrances and exits of reproductive health facilities in the city of New York. And within that 50 feet, protest would be allowed. Picketers could hold signs, people could offer to talk with people coming by, could offer leaflets, but it would impose one restriction on persons within the 50-foot zone, which is that they could not approach closer than 10 feet to someone for the purpose of oral protest, education, or counseling, unless that person agreed to be spoken to. So that it would allow the full expression of views with that one restriction that they couldn't come closer than 10 feet to someone. Now, the Attorney General's office, I as their representative, testified in support of this bill for, I would say, three main reasons. One is this, the conduct that occurs outside reproductive health facilities, the mobbing of women, the screaming in faces, the very upfront, close, confrontational tactics often used by people opposed to abortion services, causes what one court after the next has deemed irreparable harm to women. It actually can increase the chances that the medical procedures they're going for will increase the risks of those procedures. So to establish a zone like this can actually prevent irreparable harm before it happens, instead of only giving an avenue for redress of that harm after it happens. That's one reason. A second is that while the Attorney General has brought lawsuits in two different federal courts in the state to argue that conduct of the type I just mentioned is a violation of the federal and New York State Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, that conduct makes it unreasonably difficult or hazardous to enter the clinic and therefore violates those laws. A lawsuit on that basis proceeds one defendant at a time, one incident at a time, one reproductive health facility at a time, and is an extremely time-consuming and intensive way of proceeding. And in addition, as I mentioned, the irreparable harm has already been done to women. So that's reason number two. And the third reason is that police officers testified at our hearing in Buffalo. The Supreme Court held, it's the U.S. Supreme Court that upheld the Colorado statute. The Supreme Court held that the establishment of bright line rules outside reproductive health facilities or other health facilities, such as this one, you can't come closer than 10 feet or 8 feet as in that case without agreement by the person you want to talk to, that those bright line rules actually promote objective enforcement of the law and in that way promote the freedom of speech of people who are outside those facilities because they know what the rules are. Police are not called upon to make subjective decisions about whether harassment's occurring, et cetera. And so we feel that this type of bright line rule is very effective in both protecting the twin interests of access and of the First Amendment rights of people who want to oppose the services. This, the Colorado 8-foot no approach zone was termed by the U.S. Supreme Court an exceedingly modest restriction on the persons outside those facilities, and we think that's an appropriate characterization.
So, Arthur Eisenberg of the New York Civil Liberties Union, what's your problem with it? You testified against the legislation in the New York City Council yesterday.
Let me just say at the outset that the New York Civil Liberties Union has long supported rights of reproductive choice for women, and we recognize that those rights are placed in jeopardy by acts of obstruction and violence and intimidation directed at those entering and leaving clinics. And we have supported in the past and continue to support various forms of clinic access legislation. It is this piece of legislation that we think goes too far. And it goes too far, we think, for two basic reasons. First, it conflicts with the traditional understanding of the First Amendment rights surrounding street encounters, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But second, it would sweep so broadly as to, for example, prohibit striking hospital workers from leafleting individuals entering and leaving hospitals to talk about their working conditions. It would prohibit health activists from leafleting in front of hospitals about a patient's bill of rights. So we think it sweeps too broadly. But returning to the first point, the traditional understanding about the First Amendment and street encounters had long held, at least prior to this, what I think is quite confused and confusing Supreme Court decision in the Colorado case. Prior to that case, traditional understandings held that that one had a right to approach somebody, to ask that person to be engaged in some First Amendment discussion, some communication, to leaflet, to talk. But one did not have a right under the First Amendment to follow that person down the street and to continue to badger that person and to harangue that person after that person has declined the opportunity to engage in the discussion or the communication. That was the traditional understanding. We think that should be the understanding under the First Amendment. We think actually the Supreme Court decision suggests that that's the proper understanding and that there's a sort of analytic disconnect within the opinion itself, because the opinion itself suggests that the interest that the Colorado statute was designed to protect was an interest in being free from being followed and harassed after one has declined an overture to engage in communication. And so we think that there are more appropriately narrowed legislative mechanisms that could deal with this problem, which wouldn't reach as far as this legislation
like
does. Well, I think a prohibition, which sort of tracks the traditional understanding of the First Amendment, a prohibition against following an individual down the street and continually talking to them or trying to present them with leaflets after they have attempted to walk away or expressed a desire not to be engaged in communication is the appropriate limit and the appropriate way to go by way of legislation.
Well, Jennifer Brown, what's wrong with that?
I just think that the enforcement problems with that would be huge. I mean, who is going to be there to describe, to testify whether there was following or not? Was it following, or was it just that the person who was trying to talk to the individual happened to be walking in the same direction down the street? I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think that, and actually legislatures are free to choose the solution that they think best fits the problems that they've learned about. Our position is simply that this New York City proposal, like the statute upheld in Colorado, like a Massachusetts statute that was upheld by the First Circuit Court of Appeals just 2 weeks ago, that these are a legitimate way to deal with the problems that still occur outside reproductive health facilities.
I'd like to bring Deborah Sweet into the conversation, who is with the Reproductive Freedom Task Force of Refuse and Resist, volunteered as a clinic defender for 15 years, has visited more than 30 clinics in the country. With these buffer zones in place, who do the police go after the most, the anti-choice protesters outside or the people who come to defend those who are going into the clinic?
Well, I think we've had a variety of experiences around the country. In the situation in Wichita last month that you spoke about, the only people arrested there were over 100 over 1,000 anti-abortion protests and 100 and some pro-choice people were pro-choice activists who were picked out by the police under the same restrictions they were putting against the antis. The antis involved in an altercation with the pro-choice people were let go on the basis of the fact that they were only praying, that's P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, and the pro-choice people were using their buttocks as an assaultive weapon against the antis to keep them from getting closer to the clinic. That's one of the problems with law enforcement. But I wanted to speak directly about our experience extensively in escorting and being out in front of clinics in New York City with patients. What we have is a situation where there already is a clinic access law, and the New York Police Department is responsible for enforcing this law. The situation in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, a clinic where we escort avidly, it's a very wonderful clinic that really provides a service to the whole community and to women, is in the notorious 72nd Precinct of New York, where 2 weeks ago a lot of the officers were involved in a situation where four people were killed, including a pregnant woman.
You're talking about the...
We're talking about Officer Gray mowing down four people, happened to be two blocks from this clinic. So here's the array in front of a clinic. This is not nightly news, but this is what the drama that gets acted out every day in front of this clinic. There's a 20-foot display of gory fetus bloody posters that takes up more than half the sidewalk in front of the clinic. That's allowed under this legislation. There are two so-called counselors that approach every woman walking by the clinic, insistently, repeatedly, in their face. These people are part of a well-organized ideological army whose mission is to stop all abortion. Very clearly, they want to stop every single individual abortion, and legally and by other means, they are in solidarity with the people who want to harm doctors, bomb and close down clinics. Arrayed against this is the individual woman who shows up. In this case, 40% of the patients coming to this clinic are undocumented. More than 60% are on Medicaid. These are young women, women who don't necessarily speak English, who don't look at the police as their protector, that's for sure, and who are very intimidated by the presence of the Catholic Church, by rosaries being hung in their face, and by a priest who comes over and puts his arm around, "Dear, we'll help you. Don't kill your child. Mommy, don't kill that baby." This is the type of situation that an individual woman encounters, and the only thing we have found to really help that, despite the presence of the NYPD every hour in front of that clinic, is the staff and the pro-choice escorts who are out there to protect women and strengthen them.
And how often do they get arrested?
We're regularly admonished by the police to back off and allow the protesters to have their free speech rights. Meanwhile, the police never see the antis touching incidentally. They never see them ganging up two against one on patients. And we know this regularly happens when the escorts are not there.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Amara Verhaeden Hilliard, who is an attorney who has sued Washington, D.C. for the erecting of a large fence, I might call it a buffer zone, between the anti-globalization protesters and the World Bank and the IMF, and see how that fits into this story. We're talking to Deborah Sweet of Refuse and Resist, Arthur Eisenberg, New York Civil Liberties Union, Jennifer Brown with the New York State Attorney General's office. Stay with us.
And Lucille, your voice still sounds in me. Yeah, mine was a relatively easy tragedy. The profile of our country looks a little less hard-nosed, but you know that picket line persisted, and that clinic's since been closed. They keep pounding their fists on reality, hoping it will break. But you know, I don't think there's one of them that leads a life free of mistakes. Let
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, broadcasting from Engine 31 DCTV in Chinatown, New York. What better place to be in the midst of a firestorm than in a firehouse? I'm Amy Goodman, and we're talking about buffer zones. We're joined by Jennifer Brown from the New York State Attorney General's Office, Arthur Eisenberg, Legal Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, Deborah Sweet with Refuse and Resist. And I wanted to bring into this discussion about women's health clinics and buffer zones outside. Now New York City is considering a new buffer zone law. The issue of buffer zones that have been set up as a result of the major anti-globalization protests. Activists went to court on Monday seeking to stop Washington police from erecting a 9-foot-high fence to keep protesters away from next month's meeting of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Law enforcement agencies are preparing for more than 100,000 demonstrators to jam the nation's capital in an effort to disrupt the meetings. In the past 2 years, clashes between police and protesters at similar meetings have resulted in hundreds of injuries, arrests, and one death. In a lawsuit filed in federal court, activists charged that the security precautions violate their constitutional rights to freedom of speech, assembly, and petition. We're joined by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, who is an attorney and co-founder of Partnership for Civil Justice in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mara.
Good morning. Thank you. And it's good to hear your voice since WPFW here in D.C. is refusing to run your show.
Well, hopefully they will run us soon. Also, a special shout out to folks who are listening to WEOS in Geneva, New York, as well as KGNU in the Boulder, Denver area. Also, hello to KPFA listeners and to KUNM listeners in New Mexico. But Mara, tell us about the protest or the lawsuit that you have filed.
We filed a lawsuit here in district court in the District of Columbia against federal and local law enforcement authorities. They are seeking to create these large exclusion zones for the first time in D.C. using a massive fence to block off demonstrators to disrupt and prohibit their mass assembly, their voices, their speech, their ability to communicate directly and in proximity to policymakers, both in the White House and at the IMF and World Bank.
As you listen to this discussion about buffer clinics around women's health clinics, what are the distinctions that you make?
There are a couple of very important distinctions. One is just even how this area of jurisprudence has grown. I mean, you're talking right now about legislation that's being considered. Many of the cases that are being referenced and laws regarding buffer zones came up through cities seeking injunctions or legislators determining what they think is best to protect women entering health clinics. But here in D.C. and around the country, with regard to demonstrations and people having these political demonstrations, you have the police force absolutely abrogating the legislature's authority, the judicial authority, and due process of my clients by just saying, we're going to create these zones and you can't come. There's no discussion. They just announce it. And on a more specific level, I think we recognize that there's a significant difference between women who are seeking to have access to health care, who are seeking to go in and exercise their rights and make their decisions and do so without being harassed and abused in a way in particular that injures their health, as opposed to people who are out making policies, who are making policies in an undemocratic fashion, where the only way that people can communicate with them is from the streets and the sidewalks.
Deborah Sweet, is this a concern? You've been at both kinds of protests, the ones at women's health clinics, and certainly Refuse and Resist has been out at the anti-globalization protests. Have you been looking at the issue of buffer zones in that both ways?
We are an anti-repression organization, and as you've mentioned, we've been in the thick of this fight, and we're Refuse and Resist as an anti-repression organization is extremely concerned about the increasingly brutal ways in which the police are handling these protests. Certainly from Seattle on and Genoa was an incredible new leap. Now if it comes back to this country, it's really going to demand the best, strongest resistance that we can muster among people here who want to really resist the effects of globalization and unite with the people around the world. I think it's very difficult to look at this government whether it's the state or the federal government, really protecting the interests of the people at this particular time. And I know, again, back to New York City, whether the NYPD is capable of protecting the interests of individual women entering clinics has been shown through the experience of the clinic in Brooklyn where we escort, where there are hundreds of complaints sitting on the desk of the 72nd precinct that have never been addressed, where the police never see the antis doing anything wrong.
So are you for or against this buffer zone legislation?
You know, I think they can pass this law or not. There's already laws against disorderly conduct. There's laws against harassment. There is no law in this country against patriarchal oppression of women. It's so much a part of the system that I feel what's going to change things is the empowerment of women on the scene. In fact, to give you an example, when patients come into this clinic that we escort at regularly, it is the older African-American women and women from the Caribbean that is over 30 who face off the antis very firmly and say, "How dare you get in my face and act like you know what my life is about?" That shuts the antis down. Having people, especially young women, escorting other young women out in front of the clinic is what shuts the antis down. The police collaborate with them. In fact, they provide the Monsignor his own special parking place in front of the clinic.
What about buffer zones in other areas? You've been to 30 clinics around the country. When do they work? When do they not work?
I think they work when there's strong community support. I think the clinics are always in better situations when there is strong, active community support, when the staff is looking at the interests of the patients and helping people to stand up to the antis, and when a climate can be created around individual institutions that shows that a community is looking out for that clinic. There is a doctor in prison right now in Georgia, Dr. James Pendergraft, who was just sent to federal prison for the crime, essentially, of trying to get the federal government to protect his clinics in Florida. In Ocala, Florida, he opened a clinic 3 years ago where the previous clinic had been burned down twice to the ground. No one was ever caught. No one was ever prosecuted. He opened a clinic, and he was determined to provide services in an area where women didn't have services. He asked, first of all, the local government to provide police support against the 40 antis who were there every day against his clinic and harassing his patients and staff. They declined. He began to bring a federal FACE suit against them.
FACE being
the Federal Access to Clinic Entrances Act passed under Clinton. And when he began to pursue that remedy, he found so much resistance that he eventually gave up the lawsuit. Nevertheless, the local government, in collusion with the FBI, carried on a sting operation to set the man up. And he's now in federal prison not for any reason connected to his medical practice. He owns 5 clinics and is the doctor in those clinics. And he has a wonderful reputation of serving women. But they got him on extortion and mail fraud. And the extortion was bringing a suit against the county government because they wouldn't protect the clinic by allowing him to hire local police. And the mail fraud was the fact that he sent the lawsuit papers through the mail. This man is now doing 4 years in federal prison. He is an African-American provider who provided later-term abortions to thousands of women from the entire East Coast. This is a systematic campaign where we now have not just the antis, but we have the federal government, a prosecution carried out under the Clinton White House and Janet Reno, putting a well-respected abortion doctor in prison.
Let me ask Jennifer Brown, as you hear about the lawsuit of Mara Verheiden-Hilliard around the Washington, D.C. erecting a 9-foot fence to protect the World Bank IMF meetings against anti-globalization activists, are you concerned about setting a precedent with a buffer zone around women's health clinics?
Well, first, I have to take issue with some of Ms. Sweet's characterizations of the ability of police to be helpful in the reproductive health context. And just as a reminder, in New York City, there was a case brought years ago by the National Organization for Women against Operation Rescue that resulted, brought at a time when massive blockades of New York City clinics were occurring regularly. And that lawsuit produced an injunction that brought those to a halt, both in New York City and in Manhattan, the Southern District of New York, and Westchester counties. That lawsuit was actually joined by the City of New York, and that was part of what made it effective. And before that lawsuit was brought and those blockades ceased, the New York City police did, I think, often an excellent job of clearing entrances to clinics so that they could resume services very quickly. In our Buffalo case, we have now had three federal criminal contempt convictions of protesters who violated the temporary restraining order and the preliminary injunction that we won to protect clinics there. Those prosecutions were brought not by the Attorney General, because we don't have the power to prosecute federal criminal violations, but by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they've been continued, I'm happy to say, even since the change in administration. So we are ourselves a law enforcement agency, the Attorney General, and we feel that it is certainly possible. We feel that the Attorney General is now playing a very positive role, has in the past played a very positive role in New York State in protecting access, and that the police departments and federal prosecutors can often be of tremendous assistance in that. Now, to answer the question you posed, I, of course, don't know the details. Police do have a right and obligation, in fact, to maintain access of all types to public streets, to public sidewalks. Nothing in our Constitution does or should require them to sit by when large numbers of demonstrators or any large numbers of people attempt to prevent the use of streets and sidewalks for the purposes that they're there for. A fence that, if the fence being referred to completely blocks any opportunity for signs to be seen, for voices to be heard, that certainly raises serious issues that the Washington, D.C. federal court is going to have to address.
Mm-hmm. And Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, how do you think they're going to respond?
Well, I'd actually like to respond to that statement that in fact, nothing should they shouldn't sit by and allow people to prevent the use of streets and sidewalks for the purposes they were made for. That's exactly what we're saying. The D.C. police are working essentially as a security force for the IMF and World Bank, who insulate themselves from criticism, from democratic process, and they are turning the streets and sidewalks into the private property of the IMF and the World Bank by not allowing people to use the streets and sidewalks for their purpose, which is, as a public forum, time-honored, a place of debate and dissent and expression of views. So we are very worried about setting this kind of precedent in the district where you can just set up a fence. They have no basis for that. These sort of hysterical fear-mongering that's coming from our chief of police about, you know, the hordes that are descending on Washington is really inappropriate and is without basis in fact. This is the same kind of language that, if you look back, was heard in, well, almost exactly 38 years ago, before the 1963 March on Washington, with this view that these dangerous people were coming and you got to lock your doors and not be downtown. And they're saying the same thing now, but in fact, last year, at the April 2000 IMF World Bank demonstrations, those were loud, boisterous demonstrations. But while the police swept the street of 1,200 people, there are actually no convictions for violent crimes. There are no misdemeanor convictions. There are no felony convictions. All we had was essentially preventative detentions and illegal arrests. And the other folks basically copped a $5 jaywalking ticket. So there is no cause, there is no excuse for this kind of repressive activity, and we believe it is nothing more than an effort to silence this speech.
Arthur Eisenberg, legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
Let me introduce another distinction here, because I think there are different kinds of First Amendment activity. There is the massive gathering of people in front of an institution for one reason or another, to demonstrate by their numbers a massive opposition to a particular practice or policy. And that's one form of First Amendment activity. And that's very different in some sense from individualized leafleting or individualized communication. And it strikes me that both forms of First Amendment activity. Both forms of expression have to be protected. And so you can have, for example, buffer zones that allow massive demonstration at some distance, though in reasonable proximity, to the target so that those inside understand what is going on outside, and so that messages can be conveyed and numbers can be gathered and numbers of people can be gathered to convey a message that there's a great deal of support for a particular idea. But at the same time, you have to accommodate the more individualized forms of First Amendment activity, namely leafleting and individualized communication. So that if one were to erect a buffer zone without any opportunity for individualized communication, that would raise serious First Amendment problems. That's our problem in some sense with the legislation that was proposed in the City Council yesterday. And when we are negotiating, as we often do with the New York City Police Department, around First Amendment issues and groups wanting to protest, and if the police department says, given the circumstances of a particular event, that the mass demonstration has to take place across the street, we will insist that a handful of leafleters be permitted to hand out leaflets at the door, so that both forms of First Amendment activity can take place.
Well, Jennifer Brown of the Attorney General's Office of New York, and then we have to wrap up this discussion in our next segment. We're going to be taking a look at President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Environmental Protection Agency's Chief Enforcement Officer, and what his record has been in Ohio. Yes.
I appreciate the distinction that Art is making, and I think it sounds like a very valuable one. Where I take issue is with the idea that the New York City proposal does not provide any opportunity for individualized communication. People can stand, if this bill is enacted, could stand a foot away from a clinic door and hand leaflets to every person who walks in. That does not violate the statute as long as they are not knowingly approaching, and that's the Supreme Court in its opinion upholding the Colorado statute made that point, that if you are standing still on a sidewalk, you can't be touched under the no approach concept. It is the idea of coming up to people and getting in their face, getting very close to them. That's the only thing that it prohibits. So the leafleting opportunities certainly remain under this approach.
Well, we're going to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. If people want to get more information in both cases, in the case in Washington, D.C., of the activities that are being planned and the lawsuit that has been filed against the setting up of the 9-foot-high fence, Mara Hayden Hilliard, where can they go on the web or call? Are you still with us, Mara?
I just got put back on.
Oh, just the phone number?
Phone number.
Or a website, whichever
you'd
rather.
Websites. Okay. One is www.globalizethis.org. Let me give you three. The second one is beatbackbush.org, and the third is abolishthebank.org.
Abolishthebank.org. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And then in terms of the women's health clinics, where people can go for information, we'll start with you, Deborah Sweet.
Refuse and Resist is available on the web at refuseandresist.org, and we support the campaign to keep Pacifica with the people.
As well, Jennifer Brown.
Well, the New York State Attorney General's Office, I think people can figure out how to locate if they're within New York State in their local phone books.
And finally, Arthur Eisenberg.
And the New York Civil Liberties Union has a website, nyclu.org.
I want to thank you all for being with us. And in our next segment, again, we look at the chief enforcement officer that Bush would like to see put in place at the Environmental Protection Agency. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Is everybody safe and warm inside? still empty, even when you sleep. Rocks and boulders, winding trails, roots and trees won't stop your flow. You bring them love, you bring them life. Flow on down to me, Cherokee River. Flow on down to me, Cherokee River. Salt as a cloud on a blue sky. It's nature's gift. She'll make you laugh, she'll make you cry. And all the troubles in this world just won't seem so bad when you look into Cherokee River. Flow on down to me, Cherokee River.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Several senators, including California Senator Barbara Boxer and New York Senator Charles Schumer, said this week they will block President George Bush's nomination of Donald Trigardis to be the Environmental Protection Agency's chief enforcement officer in a dispute over enforcement of acid rain control. Schumer said he'll put a hold on Trigardis, prohibiting the Senate from considering his nomination until he gets some answers about acid rain. He says he wants to know whether the Bush administration intends to withdraw from air pollution lawsuits against power plants in the Midwest and the South, the source of acid rain in the Northeast, as some administration officials have indicated. Schumer also said he wants to know about Trigardis's plans for acid rain enforcement in general. Some environmental groups have raised questions about the Trigardis nomination, noting that the Ohio EPA, which he headed, is the subject of a federal investigation for alleged non-enforcement of federal environmental laws. The Environmental Working Group says that under Trigardis's tenure, Ohio ranked as the worst in the nation for its failure to inspect factories that met the legal definition of being significant violators of the Clean Water Act. We're joined right now by John Cookett, who is senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group, and Marilyn Wall, board member of the Ohio Citizen Action and Conservation Chair for the Sierra Club. Let's start in Ohio. Marilyn, can you tell us what Trigardis's record is, Donald Trigardis, who's been nominated by Bush to be the chief enforcement officer of the EPA?
What we have found in Ohio is that time and time again, where we've had significant violators and significant polluter problems, the Ohio EPA under Trigardis failed to take any action. The AK Steel facility, which is a huge steel mill in Middletown, Ohio, for instance, violated the Clean Water Act over 200 times. And these were significant discharges of things like phenols, ammonia, the acid mixtures which are used to make steel, and PCBs. They also have significant air pollution problems. I was in Middletown last night, and you can take your hand and just wipe particulate off of the siding of people's homes because the air emissions there are so bad, and the people are constantly deluged by these by the particulate and by the odors from the various fumes from the steelmaking process. And yet, despite more than 100 complaints from citizens in that area, during Trigardis' entire tenure, he did nothing to enforce the environmental laws at that facility. Another facility, for instance, the Vernet facility, which they actually did issue a very small fine for. They Ohio EPA fined them for some paperwork violation. But they missed the fact that the facility had contaminated the groundwater with TCE, TCA, and PERC. And to this day, the Ohio EPA has not fully addressed that situation. We look at Willard Industries, which is another facility in the Cincinnati area. It's an aluminum foundry. Ohio EPA fined them also for a paperwork violation for not filing toxic release inventory data, which they should have. But what they missed was this facility was actually a major source of hazardous air pollution They were emitting styrene, benzene, in quantities of over 50 tons per year, and yet the Ohio EPA didn't figure this out, and they did nothing about it. The whole question of having an effective enforcement policies and an effective enforcement agency certainly has to be able to address facilities which have major problems and correcting those problems rather than allowing them to go on for decades like they have at AK Steel and like they have at Vernet, and also being able to discover when there are problems and being able to discover the full extent of the problems, especially when they're major sources, when their emissions are in the tons, and they're violating laws, have no permits, and the people who live next door to them are suffering.
John Cookett, at a national level, can you describe how the system works with the nomination of Donald Trigardis? For example, do you know who put him forward to Bush?
Well, we know that Trigardis is a favorite of Voinovich, and that's where his nomination came from. And he was originally voted out of the committee, I think, on the 1st of August. But since that time, his nomination hasn't gone anywhere, and now, of course, it's been put on hold.
And what would it mean to have him as the chief enforcement officer of the Environmental Protection Agency?
Well, it would mean a tremendous shift from the current way things are done at EPA. At the Environmental Working Group, we've done a number of studies looking into enforcement record at all the states across the nation, and Ohio routinely comes to the very top as far as failure to enforce environmental laws. He's a strong believer in voluntary compliance initiatives and other efforts to basically take traditional deterrence-based enforcement and put it to the back burner in favor of hand-holding with big corporate polluters, and we're very concerned that that's what he would do at USEPA. Right now, USEPA is involved in a number of high-profile enforcement actions, and we're concerned that with Trigardis at the head, that they would either drop those entirely or stop focusing on those in the future.
And now, how does the process work with, say, New York Senator Charles Schumer saying he'll block Bush's nomination of Trigardis? What will happen now?
Well, what he said is that he'll block it until he gets the answers he wants, and I think what you'll see after that is a very full debate of Trigardis's record, the record of Ohio EPA, and I think some, a little bit of sunlight on that situation is going to go a long way towards, hopefully, this administration coming up with a new person, someone who's a lot more hospitable to the central goal of the EPA Enforcement Office, which is the deterrent of environmental crime.
How does Trigardis' record coincide or not with the head of the EPA, the former governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman?
Well, like I said, at the Environmental Working Group, we've spent a lot of time reviewing the enforcement record at all the states across the country, and Ohio routinely comes to the top in their failure to enforce environmental laws. New Jersey does not. While it's clear that New Jersey has had their problems, it's not been something we've focused on here because they haven't been nearly the to the level that Ohio EPA finds themselves in routinely. It almost doesn't matter what criteria we look at. Ohio EPA comes to the top, whether it's a failure to fine companies for violations of environmental law, whether it's a failure to inspect companies, even companies with a history of violating environmental laws, or whether it's a failure to issue permits on time. Ohio EPA is always at the top of those lists.
And what information do you have about Bush administration plans to announce next month whether it'll withdraw from lawsuits in which northeastern states are seeking to stop polluters in the Midwest and South from contributing to acid rain?
Well, I think every indication is that they're going to find a way to at least reduce the settlements that those utilities might find themselves in. But what we're concerned about on that front is that they're showing their hand of weakness in those lawsuits is going to embolden these companies to fight these efforts to reduce pollution from their plants. In some cases, tremendous amounts of pollution that they've increased over the years, and according to EPA, increased illegally.
Marilyn Wall, do you plan to testify if Shrigartis goes up for a nomination hearing, confirmation hearing in the Senate?
If the Senate will take citizen testimony, we certainly would like to. We would certainly encourage the Senate to have a public hearing on the Shrigartis nomination so they can hear from people in Ohio what it has been like to work under this administration and the issues, for instance, of the lawsuits in the Northeast about the air permits is also of extreme importance to people in Ohio, because it's many of those plants which are also causing local pollution problems and contributing to local ozone problems, which are equally bad for us in Ohio as they are for states in the Northeast.
According to the Adirondack Council, 700 of the Adirondack's 2,800 lakes are too acidic to support fish and plants. Well, that does it for today's program. If people want to get more information on this nomination, John Cookett, where can they go to get information from the Environmental Working Group?
The best place to get information from us is always our website. It's ewg.org.
And Marilyn Wall, board member of Ohio Citizen Action and conservation chair of the Sierra Club.
And there's Ohio Citizen Action also has a website. It's ohiocitizen.org, and Sierra Club also has a website. And if anyone would like to call, we're at 513-761-6140.
Thank you both for being with us, Marilyn Wall and John Cookett.
Someone's been digging around in my cave, and I ain't gonna stand for it.
Stevie Wonder singing "I Ain't Gonna Stand for It" as we wrap up this program. Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Engine 31, the landmark firehouse in Chinatown. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director, and special thanks to Chase as well. If you'd like to email us, you can send mail to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. A special thanks to our Pacifica stations as well as our Pacifica affiliates. That means you. Because Pacifica is all of us. We are Pacifica. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!